Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Progressive American. I'm Connor, back with another morning podcast about the news from a progressive perspective. Welcome back to the show. It is November 20th, 2021. Today, we are talking about Biden's infrastructure law, an attack on the Iraqi prime minister, and Steve Bannon's arrest. With that out of the way, let's get into the news. The Biden administration is celebrating as months of debates ended in the passing of a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. Though not as ambitious as the previously proposed $2 trillion bill, it was one of the most ambitious pieces of legislation since FDR. It provides $66 billion to Amtrak, which helps replace old trains, improve the system, and making Amtrak more accessible to disabled riders. It also helps to improve various points of infrastructure such as roads, tunnels, and train tracks, some of which have been around for over 100 years. The improvement is being marketed by the Biden administration as a great success and example of bipartisan work and communication. Just before signing the bill, President Biden lauded the legislation and promised more to come as transformative to the American political system and our economy.
The world has changed, and we have to be ready. My fellow Americans, today I want you to know we hear you and we see you. The bill I'm about to sign along as proof that despite the cynics, Democrats and Republicans can come together and deliver results.
That said, another $2 trillion in new investments are still delayed in the House and Senate, with some of the most important progressive policies up for grabs. This includes an overhaul of the American healthcare system, education, and much more. But with Joe Manchin and other centrists still blocking the legislation's growth and success, it is unclear how Biden is going to buff up his agenda with the progressive wing. Still, Biden seems optimistic, saying, "Let me be clear, we will pass this in the House, and we will pass it in the Senate." This hopefulness is not without some reason backing it up, as the House just passed the administration's Build Back Better bill. And while I'm happy to see this $1 trillion bill pass and see some actual investment in American infrastructure, I have a bad feeling that we're not going to see the level of support that we really need. To put it bluntly, the $1 trillion bill is just a small portion of what we actually need to invest in our economy. For example, half of this bill is just going towards already established spending procedures by previous Congress sessions. So that means that a lot of this is just maintaining the status quo with some investment here and there, which is why the social spending bill that is just passed has to go through the Senate and succeed, which is where the Biden administration is going to actually have to show some investment in succeeding. With the $1 trillion bill, it was significantly lower than what the Biden administration proposed, but people like Manchin and Sinema were able to keep pushing away at the Biden administration's agenda because the Biden administration wouldn't push back on them or in any way threaten their careers with reprisal within the political system. And I know what a lot of people are probably thinking when they hear something like that. Political reprisal is the tool of dictators and the likes. But the thing is, party dynamics require pressure on actors to actually get things done. It's not the same thing as, say, threatening them with legal responses or anything like that, but actively threatening their re-election. Sinema, for example, ran on a relatively progressive platform, but she has now been a major roadblock, seemingly with no reason to justify her actions aside from the donors that she's been receiving. So it's not just a matter of waiting and maybe negotiating with them. There actually has to be a bite here. So I'm happy to see that this infrastructure deal passed. I'm happy to see it law. But until this social spending bill actually follows it up, we're not going to see anywhere near the level of government support for a new America that we actually need. And until the Biden administration follows through on that, I'm going to withhold my congratulations and my support for what he's doing right now. In foreign policy news, we turn to Iraq. The Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi escaped an assassination attempt which was carried out by a drone. This comes after a contentious election which is being disputed by Iranian-backed militias, although it is unclear if Iran is the one that ordered the strike. But Iran has been seeking to influence the country for years, something that Iraqi leadership is very much aware of. Just 2 weeks ago, Iranian-supported militias tried to storm an area known as the Green Zone, home to many of Iraq's leadership. That said, Iran has maintained diplomatic connections and has denied any involvement in the drone attack. The Biden administration has noted that they have been watching and condemned the attack as completely and utterly unacceptable. Now, my position on this is that I don't clearly know whether or not Iran is responsible. I can't definitively say one way or the other whether or not Iran was responsible for this. However, considering their previous hostility to the Iraqi regime and its leadership, it's not entirely beyond reason to point out that Iran could be a suspect in this. Without any direct evidence of Iran's involvement, the United States should maintain a restrained, albeit extremely cautious position when it comes to Iran's behavior. The United States has already failed to address two major wars in that region, and I doubt we can use this as a justification to fail in a third. Iran's contributions to the region have been less than stellar, I will admit that straight up, and I am not a fan of the Iranian government or its leadership. It's extremely hardline, religiously theocratic, and incredibly violent. But when it comes to maintaining and working out effective foreign policy, some restraint in the face of unknown variables is necessary. And when it comes to headlines like this, I think that is the best way to approach this. Now, I will say that that doesn't mean we have to pretend that Iran is not a danger to the people around it. It's not trying to destabilize its countries or anything like that. Iran obviously has an aggressive part to it. But that does not change that we have to be controlled when dealing with it. We have to acknowledge that our actual influence comes from diplomatic efforts, not through warfare. Unnecessary warfare tarnishes our reputation with the global community and causes more violence and problems for us than we need. So, I don't know what's going to happen with Iran and Iraq, but one thing that we need to be wary of is how much Iran is willing to influence Iraq to the point where Iraq loses its sovereignty. And considering all we did to Iraq in the past, I think we should be wary of watching it fall apart again without somehow considering our own contributions to it. In domestic news, Project Veritas is under investigation by the FBI after one of its workers reportedly helped publish the diary of Ashley Biden, the daughter of President Joe Biden. The diary, which was stolen from her home several months ago, has been reported and republished by conservative activists. The FBI has searched James O'Keefe's home, as he was the founder of the organization, and has searched another location for the diary and evidence that they knew of its stolen contents. Project Veritas has since received a grand jury subpoena, according to O'Keefe. In a video posted by O'Keefe, the founder and controversial Republican operative said, "It appears the Southern District of New York now has journalists in their sights for the supposed crime of doing their jobs lawfully and honestly. Our efforts were the stuff of responsible ethical journalism, and we are in no doubt that Project Veritas has acted properly at each and every step," end quote. Now, the problem with that, aside from being needlessly self-aggrandizing, is it mischaracterizes the reality of Project Veritas itself. I'm not one to support the suppression of journalists or let the government crack down too much on leaks to said journalists, since free access to information is important to any functioning democracy. But this obfuscation about Project Veritas is kind of disgusting. For one, Project Veritas is notorious for using leaked materials irresponsibly, and in some cases has manipulated video and audio to the point that they have been sued for defamation, paying out $150,000 in a settlement to a former Acorn employee who they incorrectly accused of being involved in sex trafficking. They also got former NPR CEO Rob Schiller to resign after misrepresenting his statements, such as comments he made about the Tea Party. But what they did not mention about those comments was that he was quoting traditional Republicans who opposed the party, not his own views. Instead, they only released that portion of the video and audio after the fact. Others had to go looking for the information without Project Veritas being responsible, meaning that Project Veritas doesn't really meet the standard of a typical journalist, much less having the ethics of one. They're not, you know, the normal people who represent information or in-depth journalism. In fact, many of the times, whenever Project Veritas is trending on Twitter or on any other social media platform, it's usually met with a mix of shock and outright mockery, because it comes out a few days later that whatever video they use to purport and support an argument of some sort of conspiracy theory turns out to be absolute nonsense. and this has happened time and time again. And now I wonder sometimes how much the FBI may be involved in trying to suppress information, but it's usually not against people who have enough power to take care of themselves because of their Republican supporters and donors. They're not going to go after people like that just because they think they can. They're usually going to go after someone who can actually create real change. And wouldn't you know it, conservatives aren't exactly known for abandoning the status quo. So I have no real concerns about what this actually means for freedom of speech. What I do, however, have concerns about is how this case could be used by Project Veritas as a justification to engage in more fundraising, to spread more lies, and to get more people to come to them pretending to be martyrs, when usually they're the ones taking normal people's words, twisting them, and making them look like monsters. And if that isn't messed up enough, these guys are consistently caught lying and are suing the New York Times for defamation just because the New York Times pointed out that much of their content is based in misinformation or outright manipulation. Meaning that O'Keefe is perfectly willing to use the legal system to suppress his critics because he thinks it's defamation, or is unwilling to deal with the reality of his organization, one that almost entirely works to help Republicans and members of the far right. So I don't know whether or not this journal case will actually be destructive to Project Veritas. I wouldn't be surprised if they found something completely unrelated to the case that ended up exposing them more. But until that happens, one can only hope that this investigation shows just how corrupt Project Veritas is internally, and if it turns out that they were engaging in something other than journalism, then let's see that too. All I can say is that it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy and a nicer organization. Speaking of corrupt smearmerns, we now turn to Donald Trump. In yet another example of his consistent disregard for human dignity, a new audio recording shows that the former president refuses to take responsibility for what his rhetoric created on January 6th. In an interview with ABC's Jonathan Karl, the former president defended rioters who were shouting, quote, "Hang Mike Pence," after the former vice president refused to decertify the election on conspiracy grounds involving voter fraud.
Were you worried about him during that siege? Were you worried about his safety?
No, I thought he was well protected, and I had heard that he was in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
No, because I had heard he was in very good shape. But no,
you heard those chants. That was terrible. I mean, it was, you know,
he could have. Well, the people were very angry.
They're saying, "Hang Mike."
Because it's common sense, John. It's common sense that you're supposed to protect. How can you, if you know a vote is fraudulent, right?
Yeah.
How can you pass on a fraudulent vote to Congress?
It's worth noting that there was no legal basis for what Trump wanted done. And even though he keeps claiming fraud, his own government has contradicted him in the past. In other words, his whole shtick about how there was fraud doesn't really add up according to his own allies. The thing about this that gets me is that the Trump presidency was just nothing short of continued corruption and lies, and yet, when the actual will of the people is represented in an election that his own allies determined was not fraudulent, he continues to double down. And this is the same guy who consistently claimed during 2016 that the vote was rigged, even though he won. This is where I sometimes wonder what is actually going on in his head, besides the whole nefarious element of not getting any consequences and just keep going attitude that he keeps holding on to. But there's also this element that I think where he genuinely believes that if he doesn't win, if he doesn't have some element of success for himself, then it's not legitimate. It's an illegitimate system. And that's a dangerous way of thinking. Especially in a democracy where it depends upon each side acknowledging the legitimacy of that election to achieve a desired outcome. When we vote, we go there in the hopes that our system will choose the candidate that the people supported, the one that is the best for our country. And in a massive turnout, Trump was rejected by the people. He wasn't even chosen in 2016. Hillary Clinton beat him by nearly 3 million votes in terms of the popular vote. But instead of acknowledging that, hey, he had a weak platform from the beginning and got really, really lucky with his opponent choice in 2016, Trump doubles down on this rhetoric, the very rhetoric that got 5 people killed on January 6th. That's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with somebody who is a major figure within the Republican Party and its base. Even though he doesn't act like it, he is. And he's the one who's just consistently pushing this narrative, no matter how much Republican leadership will say, let's move on from the claims of voter fraud. He has a certain sect that will parrot this nonsense over and over and over again because they know a certain percentage of the party wants to hear that. Doesn't matter the consequence, doesn't matter the result to other people, that's what they want to hear, so they'll keep saying it until everybody either agrees with them or stops fighting them. So if there's going to be any consequences and this stuff is going to stop, it might be a good idea to start subpoenaing Donald Trump. Compel him to testify. Better yet, start poking at him. Say he can't be good on the stand. They don't want to make him too hard for somebody like him because his ego will cause him to lash out. And that's when you get the actual real Donald Trump, the one who isn't pretending to be this strong man, the little man baby underneath it all, the man who can consistently lie about elections and not understand what actually goes on into them. And if we can get that, then the commission will have actually done some good. But until we get that, or something along those lines, Donald Trump's going to keep parroting it. It's going to become a staple of Republican ideology, and they will keep going with it until the end of time. Alrighty, we got a good show for you all today. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Hang tight. In more January 6 news, we now turn to former advisor to Donald Trump, Steve Bannon. The former advisor was arrested for his refusal to comply with the subpoena from the January 6th commission. Since then, he has pleaded not guilty and waived his right to have the indictment read to him. Through his refusal to comply with a lawful subpoena, Bannon is the first person since 1983 to be charged with contempt of Congress. He faces a fine of about $100,000 for his refusal. Bannon, along with several other aides to the now-defunct Trump administration, have claimed executive privilege, despite the sitting president, Joe Biden, refusing to exercise said privilege over the requested documents and testimony. The day before the insurrection, Steve Bannon said on his podcast, The War Room, that there was going to be, quote, all hell breaking loose, and his comments have suggested that he may have known more than he let on.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen.
Bannon is also a major target for the House Select Committee, as he was involved with the command structure at the Willard Hotel near the White House days before the riot. So what exactly was said or planned could be revealed if Bannon has to testify. And this is really the main point. Bannon has information about whether or not these attacks were planned. And like the president and his allies, Bannon is refusing to comply with a BS argument. There is no executive privilege claim for former presidents. Executive privilege is, well, on its own, constitutionally unsound to some extent, as it's not directly stated in the Constitution that it exists. However, when it is accepted as an implied power, it usually has to do with an acting president making decisions to withhold information so his actual enumerated duties aren't interfered with by the legislature. Trump no longer has any enumerated duties whatsoever, and Bannon has had no such connections for a long time now. So the fact that it took this long for the commission to come out and say, hey, we want Bannon to testify, he's got important information, is kind of astonishing to me. This is the same guy who propagates doomsday conspiracy theories about Muslims, the end of time, and on and on and on. So it makes no sense why now we're actually getting some information about whether or not he's going to show up. And so far, it appears like he's not going to comply without somebody forcing him to. And that's fundamentally what's going to be the problem here, whether or not the commission can actually force Bannon to show up and testify. And unfortunately, it looks like whatever Bannon knew is going to be withheld unless he actually starts having to face some prison time for his refusal to comply. Now, he doesn't necessarily have to incriminate himself. That's protected in the Constitution. He does not have to incriminate himself. However, if he shows up and testifies, he will have to tell the truth. So let's try and get him on the stand. It's the same thing with Trump. These guys like talking big when they're on their own terms. But when they're not, they fail horribly. So getting Bannon on the stand, as hard as it is for the committee, and I commend the committee for doing this now, they need to push until they finally get him on the stand as a witness. Anything less is going to cause a massive delay, and it's going to dull the media cycle around the commission before we actually get to know what's actually going on. In some good news about January 6th, the QAnon shaman, Jacob Chansley, has been sentenced to 41 months or nearly 3.5 years in prison for his involvement with the January 6th insurrection. The sentence itself may be evidence that judges may be more willing to use harsher sentences against insurrectionists. And the reason I say that is because Chansley was a symbol of the insurrection. He was one of the first 30 people, according to the prosecution, to enter into that building and storm it. He left notes threatening members of Congress for doing their jobs. He is the embodiment of much of what that riot was, a crazed, pseudo-patriotic movement of conspiracy theorists and pseudo-natural people. The man literally was wearing almost like a buckskin headdress when he marched into there. Shirtless, in buckskin headdress, looking like he came out of some sort of natural flick or whatever. Like that was what we were seeing with this Capitol riot. People who were absolutely crazed, but convinced they were in the right. So it's good to see that there may be some punishments for people like Chansley, who previously had been getting some pretty deferential treatment when he was allowed to get access to certain types of food that he wanted to avoid what he called inorganic food in prison. Never mind that he committed treason. But this is just one person. Hopefully, if things go on, people like Chansley will keep getting charges like this and sentences like this. They can't just go in for a couple weeks. No, it needs to be year-long sentences. This was a serious moment, and it's time we start treating it like it was. In electoral news, former Congressman Beto O'Rourke is announcing his run for governor of Texas. O'Rourke, who ran for president in 2020 and failed to get the Democratic nomination, has a long history over the last 4 years of pushing Democratic politics in the traditionally red state. He was famous for his bluntness and his support of strong gun control laws. However, the momentum he saw in the past has since shifted, as redistricting by the state's legislature made Democrats' position even worse than it was before. Democrats have lost yet another seat in the state legislature of Texas, with Beto having supported the loser. Still, Beto has an angle to go with, as Texas's response to the pandemic has caused 71,000 people to die. Greg Abbott also faces multiple primary challenges from the right, which may push him to become even more right-wing and thus alienate voters. Still, his outspoken support of mandatory gun buybacks and the banning of the AR-15 is likely to make him a target for Republican retribution. Already, Greg Abbott's team has pronounced Beto O'Rourke a radical and has posted videos of him saying those very things, such as when he said, "Hell yes, we're coming for your AK-47 and your AR-15. These comments are sure to be the centerpiece of Abbott's attack on Beto in the upcoming election. However, there is also the possibility that other Democrats will come forward and run for the nomination as opposed to Beto O'Rourke. Personally, I think Beto O'Rourke is a good choice in terms of his actual policies, but in terms of his electoral viability in Texas, his previous statements on gun control will make him extremely vulnerable to attack. And considering how Democrats have been waiting and waiting and waiting for an opportunity to actually take Texas for themselves and push back on a massive Republican stronghold, I don't want to see the party risk its chances with a candidate that has a history of losing, especially in a state as important and as increasingly populated as Texas. Still, if he is the nominee and he does run, I hope to see him succeed to the best of his ability, and who knows, he may very well be the kind of person that could actually challenge Abbott for his extreme COVID denialism, and his extreme social policies, but we'll just have to wait and see. That's all for this week's episode. Thank you all for joining me. If you enjoyed the episode, feel free to share it with your friends on social media. If you want to see more content outside of the podcast, consider checking out the website. It is progressive-american.com. All of my content is there, including this podcast, my YouTube, and newsletter. If you want to see all my content and talk to me directly, you can comment there as well. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful day. Thank you.